As I mentioned earlier, we're starting a series looking at what we know of as the Ten Commandments. And last week we were introducing that, we were providing a framework for our thinking and talked about the two commandments that Jesus refers to as the greatest, to love God and to love your neighbour. And we saw last week that these are presented as a summary of the whole law, and in many ways they can be a summary of what we have in these Ten Commandments. And we will see that the first four of these commandments focus primarily on God and our relationship with him, and the second set of six focus on our relationship with each other. This morning we're thinking about the first one. This evening we think about the second. You see how it's going to work. And this first one is to have no other gods before God. We saw that verse earlier. You shall have no other gods before me. But before we get to look at that, it's important to paint a bit of context, to look at what God says before actually giving the commandments, which start in verse 3. Because in verse 2, God reminds them of who he is and what he has done. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. God and the people to whom he was speaking were in a deep and meaningful relationship. He had rescued their need and suffering when they were slaves in Egypt, and he'd stepped in and rescued them. He brought them out of captivity and they were free for the first time in many generations. We know that he sent Moses to rescue them, and speaking to Moses in the wilderness when he confronted him by that burning bush, God reminded Moses that he was the God of their ancestors, of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. It wasn't just that God had chosen to ally himself with a group of slaves in Egypt, but that he was the God who had brought them into existence as a people in the first place, through his call, through his promises, through his actions towards Abraham and the other great people they remembered at the start of their life as a nation. God had remembered them. God had loved them. God had freed them from the control of the most powerful nation in earth at that time. And reminding the people of that key moment, just as he's going to speak these powerful words, is important. Because it makes it clear that these words, these commandments, were never about what was necessary for the people to do or not to do in order to come into a relationship with God. They were already in that relationship through the gracious and loving act of God towards them. It was something God has done. It was something they didn't have any ability to do for themselves. So these words were not about coming into a relationship, about becoming God's people, but they were about what was expected of them now they were in that relationship. And in the previous chapter, God had made it clear to them how important it was that they live up to his expectations. In verse 4 and 5 of chapter 19, he reminds them of what he has done. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. And God is saying, you are my people. I have rescued you. I have great plans for you, but I need you to do what I say. I need you to be obedient. And here, as in many, many times in the Bible, we're reminded that coming into a loving and personal relationship with God is not something we do on our own. We are under the power and influence of sin, just as the Israelites were under the control of their slave masters in Egypt. We can't free ourselves, just as they couldn't free themselves. But we can accept the freedom that God offers. That freedom made possible through the willing sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. And we can be welcomed into that relationship. And then, just as for the people of Israel, there are things that God expects of us as we live in that relationship. Ways that our lives should be different as we seek to live as the people of God. And as we look at what God expected of them, my prayer is that it will guide us and inform us about what God expects of us today. So, turning to the first of these commandments, and presumably it's first because it's particularly important. If we don't get this one right, then the rest of them have no chance at all. It sets the stage for the others. And we see something interesting. Well, I think it's interesting. It doesn't seem to be an absolute statement. It doesn't say, there is no other God. There is only one God. But it seems to be a relative statement. You aren't to have any other gods before me. I will be first. Actually, it's not quite as clear-cut as that. People who study these things in depth say that actually there's a real debate over what was actually meant by these words. And there are two main alternatives that are suggested. The first is that the God of Israel is to be recognised as the supreme God. There are some others, but God is first. Or these words could also mean there is only one God, and he is the God of Israel. And people debate what these words actually mean. I think it's the second, that there is only one God. He is the only one to be worshipped. But it's something that people struggled with. In the context in which they were living, they and the people around them recognized and worshipped many, many other gods. It was part of their culture. And God knew that his people were having to live in that context. They were going to go into a land where many, many gods were worshipped. And God was trying to say to them, look, you need to be prepared for that. And you need to recognize that whatever these other people do, whatever they might say, whatever they might think about these beings that are to be worshipped, there is one God and one God only, and that is me. And God spells that out clearly a few chapters later on in 23. He talks about the fact that in the land that they're going, there are going to be other gods. And he says, you shouldn't have anything to do with them. Do not bow down before their gods or worship them or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces. Worship the Lord your God. So God was fully aware of the pressures that were going to be on the people. And he was trying to prepare them for that and say, you need to ensure that you have nothing to do with these other gods. These other gods that you will find people worshipping. And you need to focus solely on me. Unfortunately, it didn't work. And we see many instances where people get confused. God's people get confused as to what is going on. I'm just going to pick up a couple. One to do with Solomon. Solomon, we may know of as one of the early kings of Israel. One who was recognized as the wisest man who was alive at the time. God had given him great wisdom. But he seemed to have a problem with getting his head around this. When he was building a temple, he says, I'm going to build a great temple. The temple I'm going to build will be great because our God is greater than all other gods. He seemed to have lost that idea of the uniqueness, the onlyness of God. And actually, it gets worse. As he gets towards the end of his life, we read this, that his wives, he had lots of wives, and they turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord, his God. So even that man of great wisdom came under the influence of those who were around him and was not able to stay focused fully on God. And thought, well, yeah, engaging with these other gods, why not? What harm can it do? So that was one of the issues they were plagued with, in fact, throughout their history. There was another interesting idea that was prevalent at the time that said different gods had their own areas of responsibility They were localized. So you had a god of that river, or of that wood, and those sorts of ideas. And we get an example of this thinking in 1 Kings chapter 20. And the story is that a vast army had come to attack the people of God, and they'd been defeated by a much smaller army of just 7,000 soldiers. And the defeated army, they ran away and they got together and they were doing a debriefing after this battle. And they came to a conclusion. And Rhett said, well, actually, we know what the problem is. We should have won. We had many, many more people. We're a better army than they were. But we made the mistake of fighting on the hills. And clearly, the god that they serve is a god of the hills. So is more powerful than the gods we were serving. So we have a cunning plan. And the cunning plan is described in 1 Kings 20:23, which says, we'll go back and we'll fight them on the level ground, where that god won't be of any use, and we will win. God hears about this. God sees things slightly differently and says, actually, it's not going to work that way. Because, he says, they think the Lord is a god of the hills and not of the god of the valleys. I will deliver this vast army into your hands, and you will know that I am the Lord. So God again is challenging this idea that was prevalent in the world at that time. And so there are local, there are tribal, there are national gods. And he's saying, I am God. Nobody else need apply, is what God is trying to get them to understand. There's the importance of recognizing the uniqueness of God. He was the only one to be worshipped, whatever else others thought and did. I wanted to mention what we get in Psalm 82, because it gives us a different perspective, and it gives us a perspective we might not be very familiar with, but I think it's important in this context. Because it seems to be saying that actually there are other gods. And we have this situation where God is there judging the gods. And if we read through that psalm, we see that we get the picture of God presiding over a great assembly of other beings and acting in judgment towards them. And these beings are described as gods. I just wanted to mention this briefly, as we see this sort of thing on various occasions, particularly in the Old Testament. It sometimes causes a bit of confusion. But what it actually is doing is giving us a glimpse into what is going on around us and above us that we're often just not aware of. That there are more things than the things that we see around us. And the idea here that we get outlined in this psalm is that God has delegated responsibility for caring for the nations of the earth to heavenly beings. These beings who in this psalm are referred to as gods. They're not gods in the strict sense of being divine. That is God alone. But they are heavenly beings that God has created and given specific tasks to. And here he's accusing them of not living up to their responsibilities. God's put them in place with responsibility over the different nations of the world and said, look, you care for them in the same way that I care. And they failed. They didn't defend those who were in need. They aligned themselves with those who act wickedly towards others. They're going against the principles of God's justice and mercy. And because of that disobedience, we find, they are judged, they will be punished, their responsibility will be taken away. There's an amazing comment on this in Deuteronomy 32, where we get an idea of what is going on. I'm using a different version than we have in our Pew Bibles, as it gives, I think, a slightly better insight into this. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. And there's this idea that when God set up the nations, he also set up heavenly beings to have responsibility for, to lead and to guide these different nations. So there's one with a responsibility for this country and that country and so on. That's the idea that we get in Deuteronomy 32, verse 8. But in verse 9, we get God saying, but I kept a people for myself. These people that I have chosen, I didn't delegate responsibility to anybody else. I kept that responsibility for myself. These are my people. And linking these two things together, we get this idea that God appointed heavenly rulers over the nations, but took on responsibility for his own people. So there are heavenly forces involved in what is going on in the earth. It was true then, it is true today. God has put them in place, but sometimes they go against his wishes. And we see that worked out in the strife and the conflict in the world today. But whatever the role of these heavenly beings, whatever authority they've been given, we can rejoice in knowing that they are ultimately subject to Jesus. Peter describes it like this, speaking about Jesus, that the fact that he's gone into heaven, he's at God's right hand, with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. Jesus is that one who has ultimate power and authority. And we're reminded of the importance of that as we think about what happened when Jesus, for a moment, while on earth, shone as bright as the sun. And Wendy read that passage to us earlier. That time when those three followers of Jesus had that privilege of going up on a mountain with him. And they were encouraged to get a deeper appreciation of who he was. It must have been amazing for them. They've been with Jesus on so many occasions, seen him do so many amazing things, heard him say so many wonderful words. And here they go to the top of a mountain and they see him briefly changed and demonstrating the glory that was always his, suddenly becoming visible for a few moments. They had known the person they were following was special, but this was something else. This was mind-blowing. This was life-changing. And then, it wasn't just that Jesus was there, but he was talking with Moses and Elijah, two great leaders from their past. Moses, the one who had led the people out of Egypt, given them this law that we're thinking about. Elijah, who'd spoken out so powerfully about following and serving God. And they were there in front of them, talking with Jesus. And Peter, as he often does, wanted to respond, wanted to engage, wanted to do something. And he offered to build three shelters. One for Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. A place where they could meet and talk. An offer that showed how much Peter respected what was going on. But the problem with what Peter was saying is that he was effectively putting the three of them on the same level. Peter had come to realise that Jesus was just as important as Moses and Elijah, and he wanted to recognise that. But his understanding had fallen far short. It wasn't that Jesus was at the same level, but he was superior to them in every way. And so there's a voice from God coming from heaven, reminding them of this, claiming Jesus as his son, and commanding these followers of Jesus to listen to him. Yes, Moses and Elijah were powerful. They were faithful servants of God. But Jesus was God's son. The writer to the Hebrews spells this out, talking about Moses. And he recognises Moses' contribution. Moses was faithful as a servant in all God's house, bearing witness to what would be spoken by God in the future. But Christ is faithful as the son over God's house. He had a much higher position, a much higher role, a much higher status. There is some irony here. Moses brought the law to the people which commanded them to have no other gods. Elijah represents the prophets who consistently speak out against the people's following other gods and call them to come back to the one true God. He was once involved in a dramatic confrontation with priests of false gods, where he challenged them and demonstrated the unique power and supremacy of God. And yet, here, Peter, a fully committed follower of Jesus, is, without really meaning to, elevating them both to the same level as Jesus. And it was important that he stopped and refocused on Jesus. And I want to suggest this is still an issue for us today. Not that I guess many of us go around thinking Moses is equivalent to Jesus, but it's easy to allow ideas of God that have built up over many generations to take the place of who God really is. Many of us have been seeking to follow God for many years, and over that time have developed our understanding of who God is, what he expects of us, what is important. Some of us have been seeking to follow God for a much shorter time and are trying to gain a deeper understanding of his character and the relationship he wants to have with us. And one of the dangers, however long we've been on this journey, is that we can lose sight of who God really is. We can settle for the ideas we have about God. Ideas that maybe we find easier to cope with. Ideas we get from people we respect, the experts. Ideas that make the things that we want to do seem like the things that God wants us to do. And just as it was a challenge for the people of Israel, just as it was a challenge for Peter, so it's a challenge for us. And the challenge is for God to have his rightful place in our lives. Not a version of God that we've developed because we're happier with that God, because that God asks less from us, but to seek to know and to recognize and to be obedient to God as he is and as he has supremely demonstrated that in Jesus. The call to us is the same as the call to Peter and his friends. This is my son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Are we prepared to let Jesus have that place? That place above all others. That place where we listen to him. That place where we are obedient to him. And nothing and no one else is able to get in the way, to stand between us and Jesus, to divert or distract us from living in close and meaningful relationship with him. If there is something in your life this morning that is getting in the way of you knowing Jesus, then the call of this commandment is to get rid of it and to focus completely and totally and fully on him. And my prayer is that we will all be able to do that, not just today, but for the rest of our lives.